Serving up another plate of design, it's time for Architecture, Coffee, and Ink. Hello, this is Hollywood C, and you're listening to Architecture, Coffee, and Ink, a podcast dedicated to introducing concepts, detailing out designs, and tackling the architecture you might not realize the meaning behind. I'm your hostess, and I am here today to start introducing you to the designs that make you wonder why. So I ask you to brew your coffee, grab your sketchbook and pen, and let's begin. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode. I am excited today to be taking a break from the case studies with another interview episode. In this episode, we are going to be speaking to Robert Ansell, CEO of TNI Design and the Next Idea Group. Starting with the Next Idea, a company he founded in 2002 in Los Angeles, California. Robert is also known as a restaurant consultant, and he brings innovative and energetic designs to clients across the globe. And along with all that, he has managed to become a published author. Please join me in welcoming him to the show. Hello and welcome to the show.
Hi.
I'm so excited to have you on the show from
Thank you very much. In
Los Angeles, right? All the way in California and the other side of the country.
Yeah, in a very wet California, absolutely.
I've heard that. I'm so sorry about that.
It's been very traumatic. We've had rain since December.
And, oh my goodness.
Not something that we're used to, but you know, I'm sure we'll get past it.
Well, first, I would like to go ahead and introduce you to my listeners. Could you just tell me a little bit more about yourself and maybe introduce your companies as well?
Yes, absolutely. My company is called The Next Idea Group. We have two primary agencies. One is The Next Idea, which is a restaurant consulting agency. And then the other is TNI Design, which is where I spend most of my time. And that's an architecture and design studio. So most of our work is, when I say most, I'd say about 70% of our work is in the commercial, restaurant, hotel, entertainment sectors from, you know, on the design side. But we also work in, we do offices and we do generally luxury homes. And we've also started working on some eco villages as well. In the design side.
Eco villages, you have my interest. I love sustainability.
Yeah. So it's very fascinating, actually. We started working on, we sometimes do our own projects, and we started working on this, and we've got some interest for people that want to do it. It's not just sustainable, it's also relatively low cost housing. And then we're looking at ways to really make it as net zero as possible. So that might mean reverse osmosis water with gray water, which we could possibly reuse about, 70 or 80% of the water. Mm-hmm. And then, obviously some of the obvious things like solar powered, how we could maybe use trash as a power source and, septic tanks and so on. So yeah, quite fascinating, very early stages. As I said, we do have some interest with some potential developers, but very early stages. So we've got a lot to do on that. But we've created some basic designs, and we've also created some very innovative designs. So we're excited. We're very excited. These villages could be, anything from 30 to 60 houses, but certainly they could even be more. They're not tiny homes. We don't really believe in tiny homes as a way of living. We think they're too small. These are more small homes, and obviously different formats. So, one, two, three bedrooms, that kind of thing.
Wow. When you said a small village, I was thinking like maybe 10 to 12 little apartments, but that is amazing that you've managed to get it that far.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of land in the US and obviously being in Los Angeles, everyone wants to be in the center. And of course, we've got these huge traffic problems and so on. But I think if there was one thing that COVID has taught us, COVID taught us a few things, but if there's one thing, and that is we can work at home. And even though we're seeing today a lot of these larger companies trying to encourage people to go back to work and work from the office, the reality is it's never going to be what it was. And people can work at home. And that then takes them out of an office environment and gives them more freedom. And, you have obviously the younger population are traveling and just, you know, selling stuff online as they're moving around the world. But at a more sort of basic level, people are understanding that they can, you know, they don't have to stay in the big city. They can move out and, you know, they can work from home and so on. And I think with, you know, sort of satellite internet and so on, there will be a slow move towards, you know, sort of taking on maybe sort of undesirable land and building on it. And I think that's going to work out probably over the next 10 to 20 years.
Well, I'm excited to see where you guys end up going. But it sounds like you have quite the portfolio. I would love to talk a little bit more about your company. Sure. Could you explain a little bit more about what it is that makes you stand out and how you got to where you are today?
Well, thank you. T&I Design, and I think, you know, it's really what we're talking about, emerged from the creative consultancy, which is the next idea. And we always had a sort of relentless drive to break barriers and, you know, bring pioneering concepts to the design world. And when we do a design, we go super creative and then we pare it back. You know, there's operational and budget realities and you have to, you know, sort of deal with that. But we try and get super creative and, you know, that's our starting point. We don't let any naysayers in the room when we do our first design. Obviously the T&I and T&I Design stands for the next idea. So we're sort of fueled by this passion, if you like, for innovation and cutting edge ideas. And so we look at things slightly differently. And, you know, obviously, as I said, the biggest sector is restaurants, cafes, hotels. And we try and take existing ideas and just make them more creative, just bring new ideas, you know, taking maybe sort of things that have to be done by code and looking at them and like, well, how can you keep within governmental building code, but yet still make it look more exciting than it is at the moment? And I think that's really where we've specialized and we've done pretty well with that.
Going back to restaurant design for a second, you yourself are known as like a restaurant consultant. Now, because my Inkwell detectives come from like a mixture of backgrounds, not everyone is fully aware of what that would entail. Could we just dive a little bit more into that and how you got interested into that as a career and how T&I got into it as well?
Sure. I think restaurant design is really creating a perfect atmosphere in a restaurant environment. So we're blending ambience with optimal seating arrangements, operational efficiency, you know, ensuring that guests are enjoying their experience and that guests are, you feel good within that experience. And this all has to be executed, you know, while ensuring that the restaurant is optimized for both profitability and efficiency. So when we're designing a restaurant, there's many considerations that, you know, we have to take into account. So, you know, comfort, aesthetics, a wow factor, maybe, you know, depending on the type of concept. And really, you know, how do we create a design that appeals to that restaurant's target customer? So it's actually a delicate balance with many considerations. I think in terms of how I got into it, I think I was really just pulled into it. From a very young age, I loved design, I loved architecture, and I loved food. And so my early career, I was in operations and restaurants, but I was involved in developing companies. So these might have been startup, you know, sort of companies that were changing. And so I was always involved in the design. And I just kept on feeling myself migrating into that. When I set up the consultancy, so the next idea is really a creative consultancy and it created concepts. When I set that up, our strength was absolutely always in interior design. It was always in how we, you know, creating operational efficiency whilst making the place look, you know, really unique, different, and so on. And as the next idea grew as a consultancy, it was just no question that our strength was in interior design. And that's why we split the business, because started getting a lot of our clients ask us, well, you know, you've done a restaurant, great job. Can you please do our office? Can you, you know, I've just bought a new house. Would you mind coming to, you know, design our house? You know, stuff that we might not have known much about, but we're always up for the challenge. And we're certainly willing to learn and research. And so it got a little bit strange. You know, we had to split the business because we were getting referred to people to, you know, they just bought a, let's say 10, 15,000 square foot home and they wanted us to design it. And they would look online, like, why would I have a restaurant consultant design my home? And that's why we split the business in 2015. But yes, there was, interestingly, when I was at school and they sort of did one of these sort of personality tests or whatever, or intelligent tests, you know, they said the last thing I should do is architecture. So that was wrong. And, you know, here I am. And so I wouldn't say that I fell into it, but I kind of fell into it. It just seemed to be my calling.
Well, I think that's a really good lesson then, to not always follow just the test and the personality test at school because
that's for sure.
I think I got like solid biology only for all of my personality tests. And here I am in design.
There you are. Right. Yeah. Well, and there you go. It's kind of interesting because, you know, in my case, so I'm originally from Glasgow, which is in Scotland. Glasgow's a very interesting city architecturally. And, you know, I would stand and, you know, look at buildings a strange amount of time, you know, but it never really sort of occurred to me that this is where I had to, you know, what I had to do until, you know, maybe only 20 years ago. So it's quite interesting. It really was just, I just did what I loved to do and it worked out great. So,
well, do you have, I know this is a bit of an aside, but do you have any advice for students? I feel like in design school, at least here in the States, I didn't get as much of an opportunity to try on restaurant designs. What would you say for a design student to try it out?
I think you have to, in my opinion anyway, I think you have to look at design as, you know, this is a creative endeavor. And certainly when I look at education in design, they explain everything. They explain, you know, the heroes, they explain the great designers, the great architects and so on. They show what they did, but they don't necessarily teach you how to be creative yourself. You know, they give you projects and so on. My advice would be is really to try and specialize in something that really interests you. That might be sustainability. It could be, you know, wacky, brightly colored retail stores or whatever it is. There's generally always a market. And, you know, so long as it's not too strange, I think you'll do very well. I do feel that specialization has helped us. I think people recognize us for what we do and they understand that, you know, we might not be the right company for them if they just want to, you know, do a repaint or just a sort of small remodel. But if they want to reposition themselves, we would be the right company. And so I think from that standpoint, students really need to think and really evaluate what they want to do and then, you know, go from there.
Well, thank you. That's really good advice. I'm going to jump back to the previous topic, but you've worked in a variety of fields in several different countries. What challenges have you encountered when working on such a global scale?
That's a great question. You know, traveling is probably the most emancipating thing that you can do, and it can open up your eyes to what the world really looks like. I think we can, and this is not in any way being critical of any country, but I think, as you know, especially in the Western world, we have a set of values that are generally economic, and we don't necessarily understand other countries' values that are not always economic. You know, for me, traveling just opened my eyes to life in general, and you know, different people and different cultures, different ideas, the way people see things and so on. You know, really, if you were to sort of say, well, what are the challenges? I think it's more a question of what are not the challenges. There's typically a cultural difference. And, you know, I think from country to country, there's a cultural difference. I remember when I first moved to the US in 2002, coming from the UK and I moved to California, I realized culturally it's very different. You know, we talk the same language, we're interested in the same things, but just the way that things are done and viewed are very different. When you start going to countries like India, the Middle East, Bangladesh, some of the African countries, it's a really very, very different market, different attitudes, and fascinating. So in terms of challenges, you know, from a food perspective, if you consider that America is generally a centrally distributed market, meaning that there's, you know, large distributors, food quality is very tightly controlled. If you go to a country like Bangladesh, it's the polar opposite. I mean, we opened two restaurants there and we were literally going to the market to buy ingredients. And of course, there's no brands, there's no labels, there's no quality control. So this caused a lot of anxiety, to put it mildly. And you know, so what's the challenge? The challenge is, how do we make sure that food is safe? How do we make sure that food tastes the way that we want it to taste? And then, of course, how do we make sure that the customer likes it? Because the customer is not used to this, you know, particular restaurant that we were doing was not used to that. So how do we accommodate that? And how do we modify it? So from a food perspective, it was very, very challenging. From a design perspective, I don't think there was any country that wasn't exciting. I think, you know, there was different materials, there was different ways of doing things. You know, sometimes would maybe be a bit questionable as far as we're concerned, but it worked for them. So, you know, it was really fascinating. Africa in particular, and I'm talking about Nigeria and Tanzania, you know, if you want to learn about how to reuse materials and how to take a coat hanger or an old shoe and do something creative with it, go to Africa. It is just incredible what they can do from an art perspective and also from functional perspective, and how they use materials and how they reuse materials. It's really fascinating. You know, we see slums, they see opportunity, and they see how, you know, how they can use things and be economical and so on. It's really fascinating.
Well, that sounds a lot like what you're saying, is that you need to approach it from less of a what are the rules, legislations, which you can always apply, and more of a how do I understand the people that I'm going to be working with?
Yes, 100%. And, you know, if anyone is going to go, you know, work internationally, the first thing I would say is you need to research that country, and you need to look up, you know, what the culture of that country is and how do you respect that culture. Because they, you know, and most of them are very hospitable. They'll respect you, but they also, they don't necessarily know what to expect. And so it is important to fit in whilst not losing your identity.
All right. Well, I think that's also pretty good for what my next question was going to be. I was going to ask, what do you think students need to be aware of when designing? But that seems like you pretty much answered that already. I mean, they need to be aware of the people.
Yeah, I think if, you know, if you're a design student and maybe you're doing a sort of a project internationally or whatever it might be, even though design is abstract, if you like, it is very human. You know, someone's opinion on your design might be very different to your opinion on your design. And so I think you really want to be open-minded, you really want to research. And I think the more that you can adapt to the locale, maybe coming up with new ideas that, you know, there's an interface or something, I think it'll be well received.
Innovative, but respectful at the same time.
100%. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, speaking of the locals and the food trends that you were talking about, what does that play on design? Like, does that change the way that you approach a project if you're trying to incorporate like a certain dish or a certain way that it's prepared? Or,
well, yeah, I think so. You know, as an example, we worked on a project which, you know, food was very healthy. It was defined as food as medicine. And so we wanted to introduce a lot of sustainable materials into that design. It was a takeout business, but it was well branded and so on. So the food kind of did match the design. You know, it's healthy, organic food. And so we wanted to use healthy, if you can call materials that, but certainly organic types of material. And that's what we did. So I think there is a correlation. I think there's certainly, if we're doing something that, you know, a farm to table, then we want to introduce some kind of engagement between the concept and the earth, you know, whether that's putting in natural landscaping into the restaurant, which might be done a little bit differently, or, you know, maybe on the exterior, just create different types of designs that really sort of, you know, explain visually, this is a healthy eating place, this is, you know, organic food, if you like. We definitely take that approach. And certainly I believe that we have to take that approach. So I think the concept and the design has to marry together, and they have to really, you know, jive together, if you like. So people understand correlation between the design and the food and the service and so on.
That sounds like a slightly more elevated version of, I remember like first year when everybody was like, oh, we have to design an optometrist, let's make it in the shape of an eye. And that's just kind of like the beginning, middle, and end of the concept. So it sounds like you took it a little bit further and you're putting a little bit more effort into bringing that concept all the way through.
Yeah, definitely a lot of that, you know, what's the concept, okay, well let's take the essence of that concept and design it around that. I like your analogy, you know, an eye for an optometrist, a tooth for a dentist, and so on. I think there's better ways of doing it personally, and again, not being critical, but I certainly, we like to be a little bit more suggestive in design and a little bit more thought-provoking without being weird. And I think that's the balance that we, you know, you're always walking on that tightrope.
The good weird versus the bad weird.
There you go. Absolutely.
Is there ever a concept where what you were proposing just didn't match the design at all, that you just like couldn't jive with the food being versus the design that was being put out there?
Truthfully, nothing comes to mind. In our business, you definitely have to work well with your client. That the relationship with your client is very, very important. And if you can't match the client's vision for whatever reason, you know, then probably aren't the right person or the right team for that particular concept. Doesn't mean to say that the client's vision is right or wrong. It just, there has to be chemistry with your client. And I find that every time. And I think because we work very hard to maintain chemistry with client, doesn't always work out. You know, absolutely doesn't always work out, but certainly that's something that we are very focused on, is really to understand our clients, to get to know them, get to understand their vision, and then help them bring their vision to life. And I, you know, in our business especially, we feel that we're really interpreting the client's vision. So yes, I mean, we get briefs where they say, oh, you know, this is our concept, this is our food, go design, just come back with something. And, you know, it's an open book. And other times we have clients that say, this is really what I'm seeing, and they'll show us pictures and so on. And I that's the fun part of the job, is because no project is the same. But certainly I don't recall any project where we haven't been able to finish the job and really have a sort of a happy team, client, customers and so on. Fortunately, I hope that doesn't happen.
No, I think I maybe misphrased that. I just meant that, like, where they wanted something where the food was like a certain style, but they wanted the aesthetics of the building to be another style. It's more what I was saying, not asking about.
Interestingly, that has not, and I'm sure it has happened. Fortunately, that hasn't happened to us. You know, certainly there's a reality in what we do, and you know, it's all very well being super creative and creating fun things and all the rest of it, but we are limited to budget. We're limited to, you know, governmental code and construction code. We're limited to what's available on the market. So after COVID, there was a lot of shortages. That's pretty much gone away now, but, you know, still a problem, not as bad. So there is, you know, there is that, you know, reality does dictate design to a degree, but we just always start off from a very creative standpoint. So it means that when you're coming back to reality, you're not coming back too far that it's boring.
All right. Well, thank you. That makes a lot of sense. And it seems like a very good way to approach it. I was researching your firm online, and I saw that you guys did hemp-based design.
Yes.
And you were one of the first to use it. Do you mind if we talk about that? Because I know that plays into sustainability. And like I said, I am obsessed with sustainability. I talk about it all the time if I could.
Yeah. It's a fascinating subject for sure. So aesthetically, hemp, I think hemp is beautiful. There's really, some people may disagree, but there's really sort of, there's multiple uses for it. But recently there's sort of two channels that seem to be the most prominent. One is hemp wood, which is really compressed hemp forms as a wood, if you like. And you can use that for flooring, you can use that for wall finish, you can use it for furniture, and, you know, and so on. And then of course there's hempcrete. And hempcrete is almost like a cement, although you can get hempcrete blocks. So these are a little bit like cinder blocks. So it's a very, very interesting, material, but it's got a bit to go.
Yeah, hempcrete in school, we talked about it, like the first things that popped up was the alkalinity and the lime. Like, I'm not even sure I know anything else about the material. I mean, I do, but those are the two things that I feel like are being talked about the most environmentally. But right. I imagine, as somebody who's worked with it, you understand that it's beyond the rumors. What are the advantages of incorporating it into your design? I feel like that isn't talked about as much.
Are you referring to hempcrete or both the hemp products that I mentioned?
Either one of them, both of them.
Well, let's talk about hempcrete. I think that's possibly the most controversial. Okay. So yeah, we have specified hempcrete finishes inside houses and also inside some restaurant designs. So we've used it as a sort of finish to planters that are floor based. However, as you know, it has to be mixed with a binder, and really until now, that's, they're using lime, and lime is actually quite a strong irritant for humans. So there's some problems, and, you know, we're quite careful on the customers that we offer it to, because if they have any kind of allergies or anything like that, we tend to move away from it. So I love that the material, you know, when it comes to hempcrete versus concrete, hemp is more affordable, and it's absolutely more sustainable, and it's definitely more efficient as an insulation for a building. But it also doesn't necessarily protect against water as much. And so, you know, you can get water damage faster. And I'm also not convinced that the binder is the right binder. I think we need to figure that piece out. I think we need to find a binder, whatever that is, I'm sure we will at some point, that is less, you know, less dynamic than lime, and can be a more solid type of binder. As far as hemp wood goes, it's different because, you know, it is a wood. They made it, when you compress it, it becomes a wood, you know, dry it and compress it, it becomes a wood type product. And it's very good for flooring and so on. Where I'm a little bit not convinced is its longevity and ability to stand up to damp environments. So yes, we put it into restaurants, but if the contractor hasn't sealed it right, it starts to fray at the sides. And so it doesn't last as long as wood does and so on. And really, you know, you have to consider these contractors know what they're doing. So we have to pay a lot of attention to that, and maybe that has to be factory applied as opposed to applied on site. So I do think we've got a long way to go. But the one thing I would say about hemp specifically is, in the very long term, when we start to look at, and I'm not trying to be Elon Musk here, but when we start to look at other planets, we're going to have to figure out what materials we can grow on those planets. There's no trees on Mars, and hemp, bamboo are two items which are both sustainable, replaceable, and can be grown inside. And so I think as we look at these products, not just today, but in the future, they're going to become hugely important to us.
When I think of living on Mars, I always imagined that it would be something where you just, you know, send the ship up with all of your supplies, probably because I don't think about it a lot. That is a really interesting concept of how can you grow a material and have it be able to self-sustain enough that you can build anywhere in the world or Right. Interworld. That's a really interesting application. I never even thought to judge my plants that way. I'm going to have to relook at what I keep in my house now.
Yeah, I mean, I think when we talk sustainability, we have to look at it very, very globally. And when I say globally, I think we have to think about, you know, where we're going to be in 200 years and, you know, what that looks like and after that. And obviously, we're just sort of like little dots in a long space of time. But I do think that we need to be thinking about these types of things because it actually is very current. You know, we're doing a lot more space exploration than we've done before. We are talking about, you know, what is our planet going to look like in 100 years with global warming. And then we also have a global population that is becoming unsustainable just because of its numbers and size. So, you know, it doesn't keep me up at night yet, but certainly it's an important fact. And I think, you know, it's not just about construction materials, but, you know, how we eat, things like vertical farming, all these things that are really, really small in terms of market size right now are going to simply grow and become more and more prevalent in our life.
I've kind of been interested in vertical farming in that I feel like all of that kind of just got put on hold for the last couple of years. I don't know if that's how you felt with everything, like with the COVID and the whole nine yards. It just kind of seems like we kind of took sustainability and just put a little pause on it just for a moment. And now we're over it, over COVID, so to speak, and on the fast track. Now we've got to be sustainable again.
Yeah, I think, I mean, COVID was such a remarkable time, wasn't it? It just sort of felt like the entire world went mad and it was sort of just so dystopian and weird. And I think you're right, 100%. You know, a lot of things were put on hold, but maybe they weren't. You know, it definitely felt like they were. We knew someone out in Bahrain in the Middle East, one of the GCC countries, and he had created this hydroponic vertical farm and was doing very well. And it was really interesting to see how he was doing and the amount of produce he was getting out of the same square foot or square meters that you would get out of, you know, just pure flat farming. So I do think that we are going to have to, you know, grow that, and I think it will. And it wouldn't be inconceivable for restaurants to have their own farm in the back, you know, out in the parking lot, there's a container and it has its own produce and they're just growing it there. And I think we are going to see so much of that type of innovation over the next 10, 20 years, including robots, robotic farming, that type of thing. I think it's going to really sort of surprise us all. So it is an exciting time. It's definitely a good time to be alive, that's for sure.
I would have to agree. I'm pretty excited about the idea of being able to see your herbs being picked right before they're put on your plate. That sounds amazing.
100%.
But did you think that COVID affected sustainability as a whole, just like how we were approaching it?
I think, and again, this is probably more opinion, but I certainly believe that COVID affected everything. It really, as I said, it was just such a weird time. And I think people behaved differently and people were very scared, and quite rightfully so, not necessarily just because of the disease. Also just they're watching this world change around them so fast and, you know, shelves being empty at the supermarket and, you know, everyone wearing masks and just very strange things happening. I think it would be hard for me to say one way or the other, but I, you know, did it affect sustainability? Did not. I, I definitely feel that it didn't have, you know, sustainability took a, you know, hopped on the back burner during COVID. I think certainly from, you know, and people are beginning to wake up to it now, but I mean, you only have to look at the weather patterns this year alone. It's been remarkable. I mean, we've had 12 bouts of rain in California, literally week after week. That's just never happened. And, you know, they said, you know, well, it was like this at such and such a date, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, but it's just so unusual. But I do think COVID probably reduced people's interest in sustainability. But there is another side to COVID, and that is, you know, there is a lot of opinion where people went more natural. They felt that, you know, they didn't like the vaccine protocols and so on. And so they move towards more food as medicine, more natural, more organic products. And there's certainly evidence of sales in those areas growing. They also moved, you know, like I was saying earlier, they also started considering moving out of the big cities and so on. Whether that impacts sustainability, I'm not too sure. But I do think that, you know, people, I don't know if you remember, but there was sort of all these YouTube channels with people coming up with like all sorts of strange stuff. But there was quite a lot of involvement or interest in gardening during COVID. And of course, that's probably started to spill over into people's homes if they're buying new homes now or whatever, if they're moving out of town and so on. So COVID was just so interesting. I think it impacted a lot. But I think also what's interesting is that it almost in the back mirror now. We don't talk about it as much. It's still there, but it's just not a big topic and everyone's really trying to ignore it. So yes, you still see people, you know, wearing masks in public places and so on. So there's definitely still some consumer concern. And popular concern, but it's mitigated to a large degree.
Well, you wrote a book on the subject, right? Isn't that correct?
Yes. I wrote a book. It was very interesting. I'd never written a book before, but I'm a bit of a futurist, if you like, and I was trying to predict, and I did research this a lot and did speak to some professors and so on and behaviorists and so on. I was trying to predict what a restaurant would look like, you know, but once COVID had normalized. So once we were in a situation where lockdown was gone, but COVID was still with us. And then also, you know, what we should expect after COVID. And yeah, it sold quite a few copies. And I still get people emailing me sometimes, you know, sort of talking about it, you know, help them and so on. I mean, we predicted pretty well of what would happen, which was there would be a surge in restaurant use. People would go out, have a lot of fun, but, you know, COVID wasn't going to just disappear. And so there was obviously some concern over that and so on. But it was interesting writing a book. I really enjoyed it. We obviously had some projects that were put on hold during COVID, so I had some more time to do it, and it was a great experience.
Well, it's very, very interesting. I'm afraid I haven't read it quite yet. It's on my to-order list now that I'm no longer in grad school and I actually have free time to read books and things again. When you were researching for this and just kind of studying, it seems like you really got into just kind of population studies as a whole, just kind of like the trends in populations. It sounds like you're describing the shift from the city to the suburbs. So yeah. In your place as a futurist, can you just see this changing back and forth over time, just continuing the waves of city to suburbs to city to suburbs as events happen?
I don't see this as a swing trend going backwards and forwards. I see this as a long-term trend. And there's really two reasons, or two primary reasons. There's probably more than two, but two primary reasons. And the first one is housing's unaffordable. And even, you know, I mean, obviously LA and some of the coastal cities are very expensive, but even the traditionally less expensive cities are becoming more expensive and unaffordable for first-time buyers to buy property, and even people that are, let's say, later on in their life where they want to sell their house, you know, they're sort of saying, well, why? Because what am I going to get for the same, you know, I'll take some equity, of course, but, you know, I don't want to spend $1 million on my, you know, on my retirement home. And so I think there's, and that's not going to change. I mean, we're obviously seeing changes in the economy at the moment, but I think these will be short-lived. If you just look at, you know, longer term, let's say 10, 20 year trends, you tend to see house prices going up and down and so on. Well, they haven't gone down as much as they have before when there's been a recession or there's been a correction in the market this time around. And that's because there's a shortage. So So from that perspective, there's a noting that there is a shortage. People don't really have a choice but to look for more affordable housing. So I think that's one thing that will drive them out of the cities, because obviously the most expensive housing is really in the central, and then you just move out and so on. And then I think the second big change, which was driven by COVID, and you know, it's still debatable, is what we talked about earlier, which is, you know, people just want to work from home, or they want to work closer to home, and you know, they're quite happy. You know, you really only need a computer and internet, and you can do quite a lot. And so from that perspective, people just don't really feel the need to be in the city near work, because work is out of their bedroom or their, you know, their lounge or whatever it might be. And so I think with those two sort of primary trends, if you like, we're going to see, you know, housing move out of the cities, and I just can't see it coming back. That's not to say that the city centers are going to empty. They won't. But, you know, I was reading the other day, you know, San Francisco city center, their office occupation is down something like 25%. It's around that number. It's not exact. And the lowest it's been, you know, since COVID. And so I think, you know, that's just one example of seeing what's going on in the market and understanding people are not going to go back to work in the office. Not like it was.
When you're describing it, it sounds a lot like it reminds me of a shift in values. Like, instead, the city center can become a place of like cultural exchange and right. Free expression, and you can turn it into a destination almost.
Yes.
Which
yes.
is very, I mean, that reminds me of like the heyday of like New York City, going into downtown and Manhattan to see plays and things like that. Like, we don't do that as much now, but that would be amazing to be able to get back to that place.
And I don't know if we will. And I agree with you. It was a very sort of it was a much more natural world. But the reason I say I don't know if we will is because media is so accessible now. Even theaters are not as busy as they were, because everyone's got a home theater. You know, different sizes. Interestingly, when we're designing houses, we're being asked to create, if there's, let's say, a second lounge, it's no longer a second lounge. They want it to be a home theater. And so, you know, and whilst those are obviously affluent clients, it does sort of show where, you know, people are more comfortable just watching a movie at home, being entertained at home. And even though COVID pushed that forward, it was happening anyway. So, you know, I don't know if these city centers are going to revive themselves. I think it's going to be a long haul for that.
Well, wishful thinking, I guess.
Yes, 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 yes. They'll come up with something. They always do.
You have a void. Somebody's going to fill it. It's the one thing I learned about architecture, I feel like, from design school. As we're kind of wrapping up the interview, I did want to ask you about your advice to aspiring designers, those who are interested in the field or potentially interested in the field. What advice do you have for them?
What advice do I have? You know, I'm an individual that I just believe you should go for it. And if this is something that you're interested in, you know, research it, find out what really interests you. If you're passionate about it, get educated, try and take some jobs, you know, whether you work for free, whether you work a minimum wage, get that experience so you understand what you're getting into. And, you know, one thing I would say about design is that, yes, it's 10% creative and it's 90% execution. And a lot of our time is spent, you know, sort of trawling through catalogs, whether it's online or physical paper catalogs and so on, finding the, you know, the right furniture, the right fixtures, the right lighting and so on. So it looks a lot of fun from the outside, a little bit like most jobs, but actually, you know, there's a lot of work involved and it's not all creative. You're not sitting there 24 hours a day, you know, thinking up new stuff. But I do feel that it's an extremely rewarding job, and certainly it's a very rewarding industry, because the end result is very physical. You can see it. And, you know, it's very nice for me. And I think one of the things I enjoy most about what I do is just to be able to go to a restaurant that we designed, or even, you know, go to a house that we designed, or an office. And, you know, yeah, we did this, and it's going to stand the test of time. And it's, you know, you sort of are recognized for that. And I think that's the beauty of architecture and design, is that you can see what you did. You know, if you're an attorney, and certainly no disrespect to any attorney, but, you know, your achievements are, unless you're that sort of super high powered attorney, you know, your achievements aren't really as physical. Whereas I think in architecture, art, design, anything like that, even graphic design, where, you know, you might do branding or something for a company. It's a very, you do get that very physical result. And that's what's so exciting about it. But again, you have to like that, and you have to want to be, you know, you have to want to do it. And it's not always financially rewarding. It can take quite some time to be rewarded financially, and you have to decide if you're okay with that. So, but I do go back to what I said earlier, and that is, you know, if that's what interests you, you should definitely go for it. And I definitely believe that you should specialize. I think specialization, especially now, you know, if you're specializing in lead or sustainability or a particular type of style or design of building, I think you'll do very well.
And that's definitely really good advice for students, because I feel like we get kind of stuck in, you can only do, like, do you want to do retail? I'm sorry. Yeah, retail, residential, or thought experiments only, as I feel like how it's described to us. Maybe not exactly in those words. I really do appreciate your advice about especially specializing and, you know, getting out there. So thank you.
Yeah, but absolutely.
My one last question that I always like to ask is completely silly and has nothing to do with anything. But if you had an unlimited budget and a client who's willing to give you complete free reign over the scopes and the parameters, what would your dream project be?
Great question. I think we have a dream job. We are creating a design, and we talked about this a little bit earlier, but and I'm sponsoring this internally, but we're creating a design for a Mars community, a community on planet Mars. And it's an internal project, like I said. And the reason I say it's a dream job is because I just felt very compelled to do this. And so we have a team internally, and we're all working on this, and we're trying to figure out, well, what would a community, or what should a community look like on Mars? And, you know, how would we do this? How would we get there? How would we take it there, and so on? And we're not engineers, and so we're not really too concerned about that, the engineering component of it. I mean, certainly we see Mars being populated by robots, first of all, that can then build, and then it can start to be populated by humans. But it's very fascinating, because whenever we, and the reason that I decided to do this was because when we looked at other designs, architectural designs for Mars, we noticed that they're very functional, very steel orientated, and there is really no design thought that's gone into it. But humans need design. And, you know, we probably don't realize it, but, you know, we're touching design every day, whether we're at the grocery and, you know, looking at products, whether we're looking at buildings, the environments that we want to be in, you know, both exterior and interior. So we're creating a sort of a functional, but a highly designed Mars community. And it is my dream job, because honestly, I really look forward to doing it. And most days at nighttime, I'll work on it a little bit, and so will the team. It's very fascinating. And we don't have a buyer yet, but, you know, we will start talking to some of the large space companies at some point, and we'll see where that goes. And hopefully we can showcase it at some time. So we just don't know what it leads to. But we haven't, the nice thing about this project, and to your question, we haven't given one iota of thought in terms of budget. We haven't given too much thought about how we would even do it out there. As I said, we know that we would have to probably send some kind of robot type engineers to do, you know, to build at the beginning. But it's very interesting. And, you know, we talked a little bit earlier about, well, you know, what does that look like and so on. I mean, obviously Mars has some building materials. There's a lot of stone there and so on. But you need wood, you need other sorts of materials. And I think that material, we're going to have to grow there. We're going to have to figure out how to grow it there. We don't know for sure if there's water on Mars. We think there is. When I say we think, I'm talking about scientists. We don't know. But, you know, it's frozen. And so how can we use it? Is it poisonous and so on? So that is our dream job, and we're doing it, and it's exciting.
That is amazing. I really, really hope you guys get it. That is,
I'll let you know.
Really, yeah, please update us. We'd love to hear that and follow up on you with that. Okay. Speaking of following up on you, just to give you a moment to promote yourself, where can everyone find more information about you and your company?
Well, there's really two websites. There's I have a blog, and it's globaldesignconsultant.com, and our company, we have two company websites. We have thenextidea.net, and the design website is tnidesign.com, and that has all of our information on it.
Well, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. It's really been a lot of fun. Thank you.
Thank you again for joining me today. This episode, as you notice, is coming out 2 days early. early this week, as we will be having another episode coming out a little bit later this week on Wednesday, and another episode coming out on Saturday. Please make sure to follow the blog. Check it out, as always, for the transcripts, show notes, and sources. The show notes for this episode will be added tomorrow morning, along with a couple of great pictures that you should definitely go check out. As always, please rate, review, and subscribe everywhere you get your podcasts from. You can find me on Instagram at Architecture Coffee and Ink, or hit up my regular Insta if you really like iPhone photography. Email the show at architecturecoffeeandink@gmail.com or the blog at architecturecoffeeandink.com. Architecture Coffee and Ink is a Hollywood C Studios LLC production, and I'm excited to meet with all my designers, dreamers, and DIY enthusiasts next time. But in the meantime, may your coffee mugs be full, and your inkwells never run dry.